A sincere compliment can make your day. A few young people at West High School in Iowa City are hoping that many sincere compliments can make a real difference. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For more than a year, a group of high school students known as the West High Bros have been using Twitter to spread compliments. They single out other students and even teachers. I'll talk with them and we'll explore the power of compliments and other positive interactions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're going to spend this hour talking about the power of compliments and positive interactions. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Folker Thomas. He's associate professor in the Department of Rehabilitation and Counselor Education at the University of Iowa. And then even later in the hour, I'll talk with photographer and author Joan Liffren-Zugbaret. She is the author of a new book called How to Be Happy. People ages 11 to 92 reveal their secrets. But first, a group of high school students from West High School in Iowa City has been getting a lot of attention lately for doing something nice. For more than a year, this group, known as the West High Bros, have been using Twitter to spread compliments. Like this one: "You're extremely trustworthy. That's a trait most people have trouble mastering. You'll keep and make many friends if you keep it up." And the West High Bros are here with me now in the studio. Jeremiah Anthony. Good morning, Jeremiah.
Good morning.
Zach Nullmeyer. Hello, Zach.
Hello.
And John Ely. Hi, John.
Hi.
And Jeremiah, I know that this started with you. What was the spark that made you want to do this?
Well, back in October of 2011, there was a lot of stories in the news about people who wanted to end bullying and make it illegal. And that's how they wanted to stop it, by passing laws that said, hey, bullying is a crime. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, bullying is wrong, but a law isn't going to do anything. I mean, we have tons of laws, but we have a ton of criminals, and criminals are just people who break the law. So, you know, just because something is illegal doesn't mean that it's going to, like, go away. And then also we had a lot of speakers at West High and at my junior high, Northwest, and they would always say, like, hey, bullying is wrong, you shouldn't be a bully, and then just leave it at that. They would never say, hey, let's stop bullying by doing this, let's stop bullying by doing that. They would just say, hey, bullying's wrong, and then leave it at that. And so they never gave us a solution, and I felt that we needed a solution. So in October of 2011, I said, hey, what are the causes of bullying? And I just went back to first grade guidance. Simple stuff. Bullies, they try to make up for a lack of self-esteem, and they try to validate themselves by putting others down. And they feel that by putting someone else down, they become greater, they become a better person, they become worth something. So I felt that a compliment would give someone self-esteem and it would validate them, bring them recognition. And I feel that has worked.
So you set out to, through the use of compliments, really change the culture at West High School.
Definitely. Make West High more positive, give the people at West High self-esteem, and recognize everyone at West High, not just like the people who are in the Press Citizen every day for like scoring the game-winning touchdown or draining a three-pointer to win the state title. Just the people that you see every day in the hallways and you never think, hey, that person's great. And I feel those are the people that really need to get recognition, the people who never get, like,
noticed.
Everyone. Yeah, everyone that people don't know.
So did you see a culture at West High that needed changing? Did you see bullying going on? Were there ugly things that moved you to do this?
Well, West High has never had a bullying problem physically, and I don't think you can track verbal bullying that well. And there has been some cyberbullying, but it's never been like a huge problem. It's never been like something noteworthy, but there's definitely been cyberbullying, and I felt, you know, better start now before it's a big thing rather than later when, you know, it's huge.
So you knew that you wanted to give recognition to the people at the school that aren't making the newspaper, that aren't winning medals and trophies and that kind of thing. Why did you decide to do it on Twitter?
Well, Twitter's the new social platform. Sad to say, but people don't make phone calls anymore. It would actually kind of be weird if I phoned everyone at our school and said I was anonymous and gave them a compliment.
But you wanted these compliments to be anonymous.
Initially, yes. Just so that people wouldn't think that it's only one person who thinks that, that it could be anyone. It could be like the kid who sits next to me. It doesn't have to be my opinion on a certain person. It could be anyone. And I felt that would make it even better, because then it's just like the honest truth instead of just an honest opinion.
So as you started sharing compliments on this Twitter account, you also needed people to follow the Twitter account. You needed people to be able to see these compliments. How did you get attention? Because you didn't want people to know it was you at first, right?
Mm-hmm. At first, I just gave a ton of compliments. Like the first week, I gave 50, maybe a lot. Like I was tweeting nonstop. Not in my classes, though. But you know,
of course not.
After school, I would just sit down and think of the people who do great things but don't get much recognition for that. And mostly the compliments, they would be about personality, because no one, like, you don't write a news story about personality. You write about, like, hard facts. You write about, you know, like, presidential elections. You write about sports. You don't write about someone who's happy all the time or someone who's really loyal or responsible.
So can you give me an example of some of those early compliments? And because some people listening won't know how Twitter works, you gave these compliments to people who also had Twitter accounts so mm-hmm. that they would see the compliment, right?
Yeah. So a sample compliment.
Yeah.
At John Ely, you are a very good track runner. You're always there for me. You're very dependable. You're one of the loyalist kids I know. And you just make people feel better every single day.
And since we just singled out John here, let's bring John and Zach into the conversation. You were going it alone for a while, and then John, why don't you tell us how you got involved?
So Jeremiah had been going strong for 3 months, but it was at a good following, but he just wasn't where he wanted to be yet. So he asked me to join and have some extra manpower. And together, we tweeted a lot at night. We coordinated stuff to make sure everyone got complimented every once in a while, and make sure we didn't over-compliment people, and to make sure that we could keep increasing those followers.
All right. And how did you get involved, Zach?
Well, Jeremiah and John just came to me, and they're like, hey, we got this thing going on. We're complimenting people, and it's really starting to catch on. And I'm just like, this is so cool. This is a way to help people and to make a difference. And they're just like, hey, you want to join? So I jumped on, and we started Facebook right after I joined, and expanded it that way. But really, we wanted to get all the different groups at West. Like, if it was just Jeremiah, then he wouldn't have been able to get maybe the basketball group or the choir group. So we tried to expand that way and get every single person at West, because like one person can't do it themselves. It was just too much. There's 2,000 people at West High, and we wanted to get as many as we could.
So when you're trying to touch so many people, how do you come up with a sincere compliment for each one of these people?
Well, it's kind of hard, you know, sometimes. You just kind of have to look at the facts and be like, well, he runs track, so we can compliment him on that. Or he does this, or, you know, like, it really depends. Athletics, we compliment their personality. There's always something you can find. It's hard for the people that you don't know, and that's why we've expanded, so that we can make sure that pretty much every single person at West, we can get to them.
Well, John, do you ever worry that by giving so many compliments, you cheapen them a little bit?
Maybe sometimes, but we always know that it's sometimes really easy to find the bad things in someone, but it's harder to find the good things in someone, but there's always something there. You just have to dig a little bit. And regardless of how many you do, they're always sincere, and we always make sure that they are.
Jeremiah, this you mentioned you went on your own for a while, then you pulled a couple of friends in, and you guys kind of went under the radar for quite a while. You've been at this for over a year. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's paying attention. You've been on the Today Show. You've talked to Lady Gaga. You've talked to Bill and Melinda Gates. How do you feel now that you're getting all of this attention?
I feel normal. I mean, I don't think that anything about me has changed. I'm the same person. I think other people might be making a bigger deal about it than I am. Some people, we've gotten like complaints that we're selling out, but that's totally wrong. And if they think that, they're wrong.
Well, I was wondering about that. I mean, you've worked to create a more positive atmosphere at West High, and now you're getting all this attention, which could create some jealousy. Are you worried at all that some of the good work that you've done is getting undone?
Well, people are going to always say bad things. I mean, even before anything, like any publicity, people will say wrong things. People will lie to you. People will lie on Twitter. People will say bad things about you, make up lies about you, and it's wrong. And they should get the facts before they talk.
Do you think that you really have changed the culture at West High?
Definitely. I've told this story a few times before. I was in the pizza line getting my pizza at lunch, and this girl comes up and hugs me. And I'm thinking, why are you hugging me? Because I don't get many hugs. And so I ask her, why are you hugging me? And she says, well, I was going to commit suicide last night, but then I saw your post on my wall. And I felt that I had some worth, that, you know, I can be recognized, and that suicide would be a really dumb option. And I mean, that really,
wow.
Yeah, that really drilled in, like, you know, maybe I am making a difference. Because for a long time, I did think that I'm not doing anything, that this account is a joke and these guys know about it. Like, I've told them about, like, how I had doubts about our effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And that really just convinced me once and for all, you know, we're here. I'm staying here for good. It's worth it. Positive words always win.
So you guys are all juniors. Now that everybody knows who you are, does this continue? Can you keep this going?
Well, we have added freshmen to the account, and we hand-selected. It's not just a random kid we saw on the street. Like, it's a person we know, well, a few people, actually, a few freshmen that we know, and we hope that when we graduate, because, you know, our time's coming pretty soon, whether we like it or not, it's coming, and
so this will continue.
Freshmen, yeah, and we have a few sophomores that we trust, and they're top-notch. I mean, they're the best.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being here today. Jeremiah Anthony, Zach Nilmeyer, and John Ely, also known as the West High Bros. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Volker Thomas about the power of positivity. What does a compliment actually do to the person who receives it? We'll find out in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the power of compliments, the power of positive interactions. And coming up a little bit later in the hour, Joan Liffring-Zugbure will be here. She is the author of a new book called How to Be Happy. People ages 11 to 92 reveal their secrets. And with me right now is Volker Thomas. He is associate professor in the Department of Rehabilitation and Counselor Education at the University of Iowa. And we were just talking with the West High Bros, and they really believe that they've changed the culture at West High School with these compliments, creating a more positive atmosphere. And of course, that's all very subjective. I think they're doing great work, and clearly it has had an impact. But we can know a little bit about how compliments really work in our brain and on the people around us. Volker, when somebody gives somebody else a compliment, what happens?
What happens? We feel good about ourselves, right? It is, you're getting confirmed that somebody else thinks it's worthwhile to say something good about ourselves. And actually what it does in the brain is it activates part in the brain that then the often the more often that happens, the more our brain gets wired in a way that even if we get a little less positive reinforcement or compliments, those parts of the brain still get activated and feed into all the way we feel about ourselves.
Okay, so in a way, if you receive these positive interactions, if you're involved in these positive interactions for a long time, it actually makes you more resilient?
Yes. Yeah, very clearly. So we actually know that from research in child development, that children who grow up with many positive interactions with their caregivers, with their parents, well, they may have a tendency to be much more resilient towards trauma, negative things happening to them than children who are not. So there is something that goes on in the brain and that has an effect long term.
Contrast what happens in the brain when you receive a sincere compliment with what happens in the brain if you are insulted.
Well, there are different parts of the brain, actually, that get activated. And when we get insulted and our brain is wired in a way that we are resilient, then we can deal with them much better. Whether we can reflect on them, we can disregard them. We don't have to take them as seriously as but if we are, in a way, expecting that most of the comments that we're going to get are negative, of course, then there is not enough resilience build up that we can actually then reflect on them and decide whether we want to take that seriously or not when something negative comes.
It almost sounds like a battle between these two parts of the brain, but it sounds like depending on how you're raised, the world that you live in, one part of the brain will be stronger than the other in a sense.
Mm-hmm. In a way, what we develop in early childhood is an expectancy on how the world reacts to us and how we see ourselves in the world. And the more secure that part in ourselves is, the more that part of the brain gets activated and then can really create expectancies that are more slanted towards the positive or more slanted to the negative.
So give me an idea of – we're not just talking about compliments, obviously.
Of course.
But the kind of environment that a child lives in is what helps develop this part of the brain. Give me, for instance, of positive interactions.
Well, when a child does something and the caregiver, or the parent, smiles or says, great job, or does a high five – of course, that feedback then triggers the desire for the child to get the same response again. So then they have a tendency to do very similar behavior in the future, expecting then they get a positive reinforcement. Now, when the child does the same behavior and doesn't get a positive feedback, no feedback at all, or maybe even a negative feedback, of course, then the child then remembers over time, if that becomes a pattern, then not to do that behavior again, or may do it again or may not do it again, depending on what else is going on. Mm-hmm. So the positive reinforcement actually and the compliments, what they do is they generate a pattern, an internal pattern in the child and an interactional pattern with the caregiver to do the reinforced behavior in the future again.
Okay, so the caregiver is getting better behavior out of the child. Probably from all of this positive reinforcement.
Yep.
But the child is also developing a stronger, more resilient brain and a stronger, more resilient personality.
Of course. That means then if I become more confident, which means I then develop a trust as a child that if I display certain behaviors, I can expect something positive back.
Let's talk about compliments as we grow, as we get older. Let's think about high school students. And, of course, that early childhood part is behind us. A compliment to really make a difference would need to be something that is sincere, right?
Yes and no.
Okay.
The yes part is, of course, we all have kind of social antennas that tell us, whether something is sincere or it's not. And the more sincere and the more genuine it is, the greater is the positive effect, okay? However, sometimes what happens if people who have an expectancy of not getting compliments, when they get a compliment, they actually then are much more suspicious or distrusting whether or not that compliment is sincere and genuine. And some people, even when it is from the sender, honest and genuine, they don't perceive that because they don't expect it. So this expectancy, this working model that we have about how other people respond and relate to us shapes the way we perceive things. So, for example, I can get a wonderful, genuine compliment from somebody. If I feel like I'm not worthy of a compliment, then I may just then disregard that and say, oh, it's not genuine. That person does it everywhere. So what does it do to me? I don't trust that person. And then disregards it. And, of course, then it doesn't have the positive effect.
Right. Well, and I would guess that this is where the power of bullying comes in as well. And, you know, even if a child has had all of that positive reinforcement, those positive interactions at home as they grow, if there's someone who is tearing them down, they can really undo a lot of that.
Yes. Yep. You know, I think the high school students mentioned what they get taught about bullying, that bullies actually have low self-esteem, they are insecure, and then they are seeking somebody out who is vulnerable, who they can bully, and then create what I call the illusion of having more self-esteem, which they really don't. And of course, they are also highly suspect of any positive feedback and compliment they may get because they don't trust it. So to work with bullies, actually, and help them to get to the point where they can see something positive, that is quite a challenge. However, it is to help them learn that there can be positive interactions rather than, as Jeremiah said, then we'll just have an anti-bullying law, which means then we'll punish those kids who do that, which doesn't, in the long run, do them any good because all it confirms is, well, I'm not worthy anyway, so I just keep bullying. So it doesn't deter. At least in the long run, it doesn't help these kids.
So if you're someone who has grown up in a negative environment and you don't have that resiliency, can you retrain your brain? Can others around you help you retrain your brain as an adult?
Of course. Actually, we know from a couple of research that couples who report the highest satisfaction in their couple of relationships are the ones that have about 5 positive interactions to 1 negative interaction, which in a way implies that many of us in our adult intimate relationships expect negative interactions. And that's why they're so powerful. However, if a couple can manage to have a ratio of 5 to 1 or even better, then that makes up for negative interactions. So then over time, there can be kind of a relearning that takes place and a rewiring in the brain, you know, that then the expectancy is not up, I'm going to get criticized or I'm going to get ignored or I'm going to get demanded of something, that it can change. So, yes, and I wouldn't be a couple and family therapist if I didn't believe that that can be done. And I have seen it many, many times on how couples can do that.
That is a striking difference, though, to say that the 5 positive interactions have the same power as 1 negative interaction.
Yes. Yeah, that means we are much more sensitive to negative interactions than we are to positive ones. You know, the positive ones then get quite often that, is it really positive? There's then the suspicion of, is it really genuine? Is it really positive? Or is it just a kind of a strategy of my partner kind of to get something from me? So that it takes time to work through this until they get to the point where they can really then develop more trust in their partner and say, well, I think I can take that as face value and it's nice to have that positive interaction. And then I can deal with the negative interaction as well.
Well, we're talking about that in terms of couples. Do you think that that's true with other relationships as well, with friendships or sibling relationships? Is there 5 to 1 ratio something that you think just generally holds true?
The 5 to 1 ratio, that is in couples research. But I'm sure that the principle holds true to other relationships as well. One thing, you know, the high schoolers talked about was the question is, are you really taken seriously with this? You know, is it over the top? Mm-hmm. And I think that the students who are think it may be over the top probably are the ones who trust the genuineness less, right? So they are working through their own stuff of, you know, how much can I really trust when there are people on Twitter who don't even know me, you know, say something positive about me.
Right.
And at the same time, I'm pretty certain that it has positive effects. You know, and then this powerful example of the girl who was suicidal, you know, who comes in and gives Jeremiah a hug the next day, I think it is a very compelling and very, I think, a very moving example on how positively that can act.
Well, and I can imagine a cascading effect as well. I can imagine that if a lot of kids see one thing, a compliment on Twitter, that's reinforced by saying, you know, that is true.
Yes.
I've never told you that, but
yes,
that is true.
Yeah.
Do you think, I was wondering about this earlier today because I remember being a teenager and how very difficult it was. But it takes a lot of courage to give someone a compliment. Do you think that being able to use the internet in this way to take away that face-to-face interaction and that hurdle of needing to have kind of an intimate conversation with somebody, do you think that that's part of what gives this power?
Yes. Yeah, in a way, I think, you know, adolescents these days, they live in different worlds. Actually, all adolescents live in different worlds. But one social world that has been created for them is the one that requires less face-to-face interaction, which is much safer. Yeah, and so then to use this quasi-reality, not face-to-face reality, as kind of a safe springboard to do something different, to interact in a different way, I think that's a wonderfully creative idea on how to use Twitter and Facebook.
Well, and it's wonderful, I think, because of course, one of the things that gives cyberbullies power is that anonymity as well.
That's
so
right.
It's using that same power.
Yeah.
Let's talk about positive thinking within ourselves. I know that a lot of us, you know, look in the mirror and think, oh, I should be thinner. I don't like my body. I don't like my hair, you know, that kind of thing. Or we just don't, we criticize ourselves a lot. If you work on changing the messages you're giving yourself, how does that affect you?
Positively. See, in a way, we all have bullies within ourselves. Bullying is not just a social interactional phenomenon. We have these critical voices that you just mentioned. So many people, adults as well as children and adolescents for that matter, who have many critical voices within them, try to fight those critical voices and then try to find ways on how they can get away from them. But the more they try, the more powerful they become. So to, in a way, have an interaction, kind of a conversation, an internal conversation with our own bullies and acknowledge them, that they are actually not bad, negative, evil, but that they are, in a way, telling them something about themselves, and to accept them for who they are and then let them go, that actually then creates more positive internal interactions that we can have with ourselves. I think we're trying way too hard to get rid of our internal bullies rather than embracing them and telling them, oh, you know, you don't have to have that much power over me. You know, the more I try to get rid of me, the more power you have over me. So it's kind of, in a way, kind of a paradoxical thing, which, by the way, works with interactional bullies as well. They're really thriving on feeling intimidated by them. And kids who are not intimidated by bullies get bullied much less than people who are vulnerable and feel very threatened by them. And that's the same with our kind of internal voices that operate like bullies and tell us how bad we are and what bad things we're doing.
We have David on the line in Iowa City at 866-780-9100. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. Hello, David.
Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to ask?
Well, I fully support the idea those kids have, and I think it's great. It's just great. But to play devil's advocate for a moment here, sometimes kindness has a sort of backfire for the person that gives it because they get made fun of for being that way. There's a negativity associated with being positive. And people in a school environment especially like that, where character education is presumably already a part of what they're doing, there gets to be perhaps an image among some of the students, and therefore a force against the positive, making fun of the kindness and the compliments. And I just wanted you to comment on how you deal with that right up front, how you kind of jujitsu that into maybe a positive as well. I don't know.
All right, David, thanks for your call.
David, that's a very good question. And as I said, then kind of disregarding the kindness, quite often I would see that as kind of a defensive stance in accepting the kindness and the positiveness, because you're not sure about the person who is kind to you, especially if it's a stranger. How you can build that in as the person who is delivering the kindness is to acknowledge that it is up to the person to accept that kindness or to disregard it. And that the person who actually delivers the kindness is not entitled to a positive response. So that it is up to the person who is the recipient of the kindness to do with the kindness what he or she wants to do with it, you know, rather than expecting that it has to be replicated or at least acknowledged.
We can talk more about this after the break. Being kind, you do make yourself vulnerable. We can talk about that in a moment. I'm talking with Volker Thomas, who's an associate professor in the Department of Rehabilitation and Counselor Education at the University of Iowa. In just a moment, we're also going to get some thoughts on how to be happy from people ages 11 to 92 from a new book by Joan Lifring-Zogbure. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're exploring the power of positive interactions, the power of compliments, the power of positive thinking. With me right now is Volker Thomas. He's associate professor in the Department of Rehabilitation and Counselor Education at the University of Iowa. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Volker, we were talking about trying to get along with that inner bully that so many of us have. When you're trying to retrain yourself, you talked about embracing the inner bully, but saying, you know, you don't have that much power over me. You don't need to have that much power over me. How do you start doing that? Like, you know, if you're someone who is hypercritical of yourself, how do you start changing those messages?
Well, for people who have a tendency to have internal conversations with themselves, well, they can do that with themselves, at least can start. You know, most of us are more what I would call external communicators. To have somebody that you really trust, for adolescents, usually that's peers, to be able to talk with them about that there are these critical voices and what these critical voices, you know, kind of say in these internal conversations. That's the first step. So in a way, it's kind of an externalizing, putting out into relationships with others our internal conversations that we struggle with. And when somebody who I confide in, who I trust, then actually can validate that it's okay that these negative voices are there, these critical voices. That's the first step then to kind of redefine the relationship with these critical voices inside. So in a way, the social context of having somebody who can validate that so that I don't have to do it by myself, because that's so much more difficult, because then the critical voice is going to say, oh, come on, don't do this.
Right.
You know, that is something that is a good step.
Well, you know, and particularly in the 1980s, we made a fun of the self-actualization
yes.
kind of stuff a lot. Gosh darn it, I'm worth it. You know, people like me. does saying nice things to yourself, does that help if you start just saying those things out
loud?
Oh,
yes. And there are these days, you know, there are techniques where you can meditate with a positive mantra. You know, tell yourself positive things. In cognitive therapy, there are techniques that can be used actually to deconstruct the negative thoughts and replace them with positive thoughts. So there's plenty that can be done to do this internal restructuring.
All right, but it's not easy.
It's work because, you know, these negative voices inside, they're pretty powerful. And they come back. You know, they're not going to just go away. They're in a way, you know, like, as I said, like the bully who is in really so insecure that they need something.
Mm-hmm. And I think we should also make a point here that there depression is very real. There are lots of negative forces that cannot be overcome necessarily.
No. Oh, of course.
Yeah, that's
right.
There are
limitations to that. Yeah, there is mental illness that cannot be overcome just by trying to think in a different way.
But this is a powerful thing.
Yes, it is.
Volker Thomas is with me. He's going to stay with us, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Joining us now is Joan Liffring-Zug-Bure, and she's a well-known author and photographer, and she has just published a new book called How to Be Happy: People Ages 11 to 92 Reveal Their Secrets. Hello, Joan.
Thank you for having me come.
Well, thank you for coming back. And what gave you the idea of exploring? Now, I mean, this is not all of the people that you feature in the book are wildly happy people, but you have collected their reflections on happiness. Why did you want to do that?
Well, first of all, I had some photographs that I'd taken of some of these happy people that were kind of interesting, like Reverend Bill Eckhart with the white beard and a dog that was a Maltese that was totally white, and it was kind of an interesting picture. And then I had met Phyllis Dale from Florida, who used to be a riverboat entertainer, you know, a piano bar person, and she had an absolutely enormous red hat, which she showed me because she was going to do a radio program in Missouri about having to do with riverboats, and I took a picture of her, and I thought, well, you know, it would be really kind of fun to assemble a book of the more interesting portraits or candids of people, and I try to surround myself with people who are happy and not with people who are depressed and negative, because I think you have quite a bit of choice as to whether you're happy or and positive or whether you're negative. And many of the people in this book have overcome terrible things that have happened to them, like Marcia Wegman lost a 12-year-old son in an airplane crash, and she went a new spiritual path as a result. And other people in the book have overcome cancer or are in remission, and they try to have happy attitudes.
What was it that made you so focused on happiness and trying to surround yourself with this kind of positive energy?
Well, I had a very miserable childhood with relatives who were extremely neurotic in one way or another and rather negative and depressed, and their attitudes were pretty grim. And then I had been divorced, and I was 34 years old, and I looked around and said, I don't want these people in my life.
So you made a very conscious decision in your own life.
Yes, and I think who you surround yourself with is to some extent a reflection of how you yourself want to be.
When you started asking people for their reflections on happiness, you mentioned that you had these wonderful pictures, and the pictures are just fabulous, Joan. But when you started asking people for their reflections on happiness, what kind of responses did you get?
Well, they were happy to be included in a book by me. You know, there's some ego involved in all of us. But I think one of the interesting aspects of this book is that I had the people, for the most part, write their own stories in their own words rather than my writing it as a journalistic reporter. Except the only people that I didn't really have write it were Jane McCune and Bob Wachel of Iowa City. And I asked why they were happy in their marriage, and they said because they were so respectful of each other. So I just used that as a tagline in their photograph.
You include so many of these stories, and there is there are a number of threads among the different stories, but one of them that's interesting, you already mentioned Marcia Wegman, who lost a son who was 12 years old in a terrible accident. And I found that there was this thread of people who had really gone through something heartbreaking, something difficult, and that almost gives them more perspective on what it means to be happy and how to be happy.
Well, and they work at it. I mean, it isn't just an accident that happens to them. They wake up one day and the sun is shining and they say, I'm going to be happy today. They find reasons to be happy in terms of their human relationships with other people. And, you know, the Americans are depicted as being extremely materialistic, wanting an abundance of all the things in a Walmart or a Kmart. And none of the people in this book have said that things and possessions add to their happiness. It's human relationships with each other. And I think that that is really a wonderful theme of this book.
You also, you include a story, you call it Laughing Myself Happy, or she called it Laughing Myself Happy. And this is from Reverend Laura Gentry McGregor, or from McGregor, Iowa. And she writes about just being a very happy child, but then going through some extraordinarily difficult things in her life and making a decision to be happy and to try to spread that with other people. She calls herself the laughter ambassador. When you got these stories and you read these stories, what did you take away from them?
Well, it made me happy to find that everybody in my book is happy and that in general, a great many of these people are very close friends of my husband and mine. My husband, Dwayne, is very supportive of all my projects.
You wrote about your dog.
Well, May is a most wonderful dog that we've ever met, and she's happy all the time, too. Although she's had some rejections in life, she wanted to, well, she was courted by a French poodle by email when she was young, and they exchanged pictures by email. And then Gus, who lives in Illinois, made a fatal mistake. He sent May a photograph of Olive nursing his puppies. So May immediately had a hysterectomy and was a little depressed. And then she took up laughter yoga for dogs, aided by Laura Gentry.
Okay.
And they tried on various costumes. Laura dresses in funny costumes when she does group presentation. So then I decided that maybe May should submit her portfolio to an agency in New York City. But the Weimaraner syndicate rejected her, and those are the dogs of Bill Wegman, a photographer. And those dogs are on calendars and in books and in art shows, and they're all over the place, and they're very funny.
And you clearly find a great deal of joy in May.
Oh, sure. May's the best dog we've ever met. You can have goodies spread on a coffee table, and she doesn't touch them. She does whatever she's told to do.
And she's a published author as well.
Yes, she did a book called Finding My Way.
So In focusing on May and other, now a dog is not a small thing. Clearly she's a member of your family and she's very important to you. But I think that some people might be surprised to find your contribution to the book with all of these reflections on happiness and these amazing life stories is focused on your dog. Why is she so important to you that's your contribution?
Well, Dwayne, my husband, indicates that May makes him laugh every day because she's funny and she's cute and she's a big dog. She's overcome something too. She was a Labradoodle reject. Her mother should have been a full doodle, poodle and Labrador. And her father was a doodle. And so poor May, instead of being 50-50, wound up being 3/4 Labrador and 1/4 poodle. And the man who had bred her mother with the poodle, Labradoodle, wanted to sell them. And he realized that he had a reject adopted batch of puppies. And a friend of his in Northeast Iowa said she would find them homes and advertised labradoodles. And Duane was reading the Sunday Gazette and normally never reads the dog ads and found this dog advertised for $75. And that was a real bargain because most doodles are in the $2,000 range.
So what I'm getting from you, Joan, is that you've made a decision in your life to be happy. Do you think that's something most people can do?
I think they can go a long ways toward having positive thoughts instead of negative thoughts.
And Volker, can you weigh in on that? Do you think that making a decision to be happy is something that many of us can do?
Oh, I think everybody can do it. However, there are some limitations to that. You know, there are some people who are so traumatized internally and externally that even deciding to only think positively doesn't necessarily work with them. So they would need some external help to do that. But I think most of us who have experienced unhappiness, and I think in order to be happy, you have to have experienced unhappiness. Otherwise, you wouldn't know. You know, I think we can do quite a bit, especially in social relationships. And that's what I hear from your book. Mm-hmm. You know, this is all embedded in social relationships. There are people actually who support positive thinking, including dogs. I have a dog, too, who, and you know, we talk about an unconditional love so much. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wonder whether humans are really capable of this. But I know dogs are capable of unconditional love. And that's why they are so important for many humans. Because, you know, they get positivity from their dog no matter what. Whether I'll get it from my kids or from my wife, I don't know.
I think Reverend Laura Gentry is an example because in her essay about how to be happy, she tells of her aunt who was depressed, horribly depressed. And Laura probably felt maybe there's a genetic component there, but I will try to overcome my genetics and seek ways to be happy. And an Indian medical doctor in India started a happy program for his patients, and it has spread to 7 continents. And Laura's the first laughter yoga teacher in Iowa.
I think we'll have to explore that on another day, mm-hmm. in fact. And Volker, I'll let you have the final word. If someone listening today is having a very difficult time in their lives and they think, you know, that sounds so easy to just choose to be happy, where do you start? How do you start to turn things around?
Find somebody that you can confide in and talk about the unhappy parts and the happy parts. So in a way, externalize this internal negative, these negative conversations that people have with each other or with themselves, with somebody else, and go from there. And that can be a partner, a friend. It can be a professional if that's necessary. But people with support from others and validated by others can turn their thinking around and think more positively.
Volker Thomas, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Volker Thomas is Associate Professor in the Department of Rehabilitation and Counselor Education at the University of Iowa. And Joan Liffring-Zugbure, thank you so much.
Thank you. The book's available on Amazon and Prairie Lights.
All right, and the book is How to Be Happy, People Ages 11 to 92 Reveal Their Secrets. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow at this time, Governor Terry Branstad delivers his State of the State address. We will be broadcasting that live tomorrow. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.